brink, but its pulse remains weak. But the pace and brutality of the geopolitical changes since mid-November have been to a climate deal on life support, like a cluster bomb dropped on a hospital. In just 6 months, a world slowly recovering from a pandemic has been racked by war, which, in turn, has created chaos in energy markets, sent food prices surging, and threatened shortages, raised inflation and a specter of recession and unrest, and has upended geopolitical relations. Fossil fuel companies are enjoying a bonanza when they were supposed to be dying out. World leaders who 6 months ago were pledging net zero carbon emissions are now licensing new oil and gas drilling. Coal demand has surged and investors are sitting on scores of carbon bombs. High-stakes oil, gas and coal projects that, if followed through, would eliminate any hope of keeping to a 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise. It will be easy to think of the Glasgow climate deal and the chance of a 1.5 degrees Celsius limit as another casualty of the conflict in Ukraine. 6 months from now, the world will meet again for the next round of climate talks in Egypt, which is yet to set out a clear programme. Rachel Kite, Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University and a United Nations climate advisor, says the COP27 summit must focus on implementation. That means ensuring that the promises made in the Glasgow summit are not forgotten or fought over, but put into practice as swiftly as possible. Rachel Kite says, putting off tomorrow that which needs to be done today has come back to bite us. Decades of underinvestment in infrastructure, of too slow progress on protecting nature, faltering responses to rising inequality, undervaluing energy efficiency, now we find ourselves scrambling to swing away from fossil fuels, to ramp up renewable energies, respond to famine and food price shocks, and with inflation on the rise and economic growth stalling, and very little of the policy frameworks we need to make the transitions move smoothly at speed. 2021 was about ambition. 2022 is about following through. 30 years of climate negotiations have seen and weathered plenty of previous conflicts, and insiders say countries are practiced at keeping discussions under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the parent treaty to the Paris Climate Accord, separate from the other geopolitical upheavals. Outright hostility at the summit is unlikely. A worse danger is the indifference and love of the status quo experts fear countries are reverting to under cover of the conflict in Ukraine. For the countries that want progress, the key will be to keep international focus on the effects of the Ukraine crisis on national security in the developed world and of the climate crisis in the developing world, such as the record heat waves in India and Pakistan. Soaring energy prices as a result of the Ukraine war have prompted a rapid reappraisal of energy policies across the world, particularly in Europe. Before the conflict in Ukraine, Germany depended on Russia for about two-thirds of its gas supplies and the European Union for about 40% of its energy. The bloc's attempts to wean itself off these sources are likely to be painful in the short term, but have accelerated a move that needed to be made in the long term to reach the target of net zero emissions by 2050. According to Fatih Birol, Executive Director of the International Energy Agency, IEA, and one of the world's foremost energy economists, there are three clear answers to this energy crisis. Countries must seek to replace Russian fossil fuels in the short term by squeezing more out of their current supplies. Urgent measures such as turning down thermostats, imposing speed limits on cars, and installing home insulation must be taken to cut down on demand. And renewable energy must be ramped up fast by removing barriers such as planning problems and grid connections. Fatih Birol says, "I believe we have the chance to make this a historic turning point towards a cleaner and a more secure energy system. This is the first time I have seen such momentum behind change in the energy sector." However, this optimistic view depends on countries seizing the opportunities of renewable energies and ignoring the pleas of big oil. Fossil fuel companies have pledged to plough a proportion of their cash into clean energy, but many are just as likely to pour it into fresh extraction. The Guardian has uncovered nearly 200 examples of new fossil fuel projects now under development that, if brought to fruition, would result in a billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions, or about 18 years' worth of emissions at current levels. That would put paid to any hope of staying within the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. While Europe appears to be moving towards cleaner energy, the United States is facing a continued logjam in Congress. Legislation proposed by President Biden, crucial to fulfilling the promises he made in Glasgow to reducing emissions, is stuck because of refusal of one Democratic senator, Joe Manchin, to agree. Nevertheless, the Biden administration is determined to push forward. John Kerry, the US Special Presidential Envoy on Climate Change, says, "I'm hopeful that in the next weeks, maybe Congress can be able to pass some kind of climate legislation, which will be helpful." President Biden is committed to moving forward, and obviously he has administrative powers and can issue certain executive orders and do certain things. Meanwhile, this year has already seen record heat waves in India and Pakistan that have caused widespread misery, disruption, damage to crops, and fears for people's health. These devastating events are happening at 1.2 degrees Celsius of global heating, and according to new research from the Met Office and the World Meteorological Organization, we are likely to see global temperatures top 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels within the next 5 years. That does not spell the end of the 1.5 degrees Celsius goal. Temperatures could overshoot the limit in some years without settling above it for the long term. But the conclusions are inescapable. The kind of disasters we're seeing in South Asia, the flooding in Australia and South Africa, and the droughts and wildfires in North America will rapidly become the norm, with consequences for humanity that will far outstrip the effects of any war yet experienced.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
On Saturday, a gunman attacked a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and injuring 3 others. Most of the victims were African American, making the attack one of the deadliest racially charged mass shootings in the United States' recent history. According to the police, the detained suspect, identified as 18-year-old Peyton Gendron, drove over 200 miles to carry out the attack. The law enforcement also said they were reviewing a 180-page document published online detailing the gunman's motivations. In the so-called manifesto, the author describes themselves as a white supremacist concerned about, quote, the dwindling white population. The document also says that he chose the area for the attack as its zip code has a large black population, which was within the driving distance of where he lived.
The inability of the unsustainability of neoliberal capitalism. So there's less resources, there's scarcity, there's a job market is being affected. Everyone is affected by that, but their interpretation of what the problem is different. And for white extremists, white supremacist extremists, they blame immigrants, they blame black people, they blame. And so you're seeing these ideologies that are emerging, or mentalities, or not emerging. They've always existed, but they're responding to the intensification of the logical conclusions of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism, austerity, joblessness, you know, privatization, all of that.
The police are investigating the attack as a hate crime, as an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The teenager faces first-degree murder, a charge he has pleaded not guilty to. Among the victims were a father who was buying a birthday cake for his 3-year-old son, and Catherine Massey, a 72-year-old woman who was known for her civil rights advocacy. The tragic irony is that almost a year ago, she had written a letter to a local newspaper calling for stricter gun control measures. The Buffalo mass shooter managed to live stream his attack on a popular streaming service using camera gear mounted on his military helmet. Although the feed was taken down soon after it began, the issue reignited criticisms about the moderation of social media platforms. It bore striking similarities with the 2019 terrorist attack on two mosques in the city of Christchurch in New Zealand that killed 51 people. That attack was also streamed live on social media. The incident in Buffalo is considered the deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. so far this year. But some 200 other mass shootings were carried out since the beginning of January. Unofficial data suggests that over 320 people are shot in the U.S. every day. A recent report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that gun violence in the country rose dramatically in 2020, with homicides involving firearms surging by 35%, the highest level in 25 years. The report points to disparities in the rates of homicide based on race, ethnicity, and poverty. This study fails to single out the specific reason for such inequality, but cites the COVID-19 pandemic as a possible socioeconomic driving factor.
People having to seek their own interpretations of what's happening. We're seeing it like things like this shooting, and this is not the only shooting. There's other things that are happening where people are acting out, trying to figure out, you know, just acting out, reactionary, most extreme reactionary responses to what's happening. And it can only get worse. As long as capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy are the rule of the day in the United States, they can't address the fundamental human needs of people, then things like this will get worse. And then as the media glosses over it and doesn't want to tell people the truth, they can only get worse.
Tragic incidents like these are a grim reminder of the need for tighter gun control laws that would prevent easy access to firearms and reforms that would rid the U.S. society of racial and ethnic biases.
Okinawa, a Japanese island in the Western Pacific Ocean. The island was the scene of one of the fiercest battles of the Pacific War. It has marked the 50th anniversary of the end of U.S. occupation and its return to Japanese sovereignty after 27 years of U.S. rule. Okinawa returned to Japan on May 15, 1972. However, the island chain still hosts the majority of American military bases in Japan. It harbors about 70% of the U.S.'s military bases in Japan and more than half of its 47,000 troops. Many Japanese people, particularly Okinawans, are against the continued heavy American military presence and are protesting to draw attention to the issue.
Far from being reduced as people in Okinawa demand, the U.S. military bases have even been strengthened instead. We hope the rally will help people in the prefecture and in other places realize the seriousness of the issue.
The presence of U.S. troops in Japan is not in any way intended to protect Japanese citizens, but a part of U.S. military strategy. Frequent incidents caused and crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan only make Okinawa more dangerous.
Hundreds of protesters from across Japan have staged rallies in Okinawa demanding a reduction of U.S. military forces in the prefecture. In the city of Naha, more than 1,000 people from Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as Okinawa held an indoor gathering to call for peace and to oppose U.S. bases. Japanese locals on Okinawa have already been expressing serious opposition to the presence of U.S. forces on the island. A poll by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper and Okinawan media organizations found that 61% of local people wanted fewer U.S. bases on the island, while only 19% said they were happy with the status quo. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, who promised to make a greater effort to reduce hosting U.S. military bases in the region, also acknowledged the issue as well as the economic inequalities that still make Okinawa one of the country's poorest areas.
50 years have passed since Okinawa's reversion to Japan, and the people of Okinawa still bear a heavy burden from the U.S. bases. The government takes this very seriously and will continue to do the utmost to reduce the burden from the bases.
A string of tropical islands located off far southwest Japan, Okinawa, has suffered massive devastation in World War II. Fierce battles between Japanese and American forces left as many as one-third of its people dead. Then around 30 years of U.S. rule followed. And Japan has not forgotten those days. Despite their opposition to U.S. troop presence, Okinawans are more concerned about the threat of a military confrontation involving China. Okinawa is closer to Taiwan than the capital, Tokyo. This could turn it into a target to be the front line in case of a conflict between the U.S. and China. Beijing considers Taiwan as its territory and views U.S. military provocations as a sign of support for those inside Taiwan who seek independence. American warships periodically carry out voyages through the strategic Taiwan Strait, drawing angry responses from China. The U.S. is also the island's key backer and main arms supplier. Tensions in Okinawa are likely to rise further given that lawmakers in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have said that they want a commitment to more defense spending, including missiles that can hit targets on foreign soil, missiles that could be deployed on Okinawa.
The United States uses its force and uses its bullying tactics to impose its will on other countries. So I don't know that in the minds of the Japanese government that they are really able to operate as totally sovereign, independent entities when it comes to going against the interests of the United States.
Considering the latest developments, Okinawa could soon find itself in the middle of another conflict, one that is reminiscent of a dark point in its history. And this time again, Washington plays a role in it. On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghaleh was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of culture and people have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation, and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shirin Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shirin and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2025 and can be nearly halved this decade to give the world a chance of limiting future heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Fiona Harvey, under the heading, IPCC Report, Now or Never, If World is to Stave Off Climate Disaster. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. In what is in effect a final warning for governments on the climate, scientists have said the world can still hope to stave off the worst ravages of climate breakdown, but only through a now-or-never dash to a low-carbon economy and society. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2025 and can be nearly halved this decade to give the world a chance of limiting future heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The final cost of doing so will be minimal, amounting to just a few percent of global GDP by mid-century, though it will require a massive effort by governments, businesses, and individuals. But the body of the world's leading climate scientists warned the chances were narrow, and the world was failing to make the chances needed. Temperatures will soar to more than 3 degrees Celsius, with catastrophic consequences unless policies and actions are urgently strengthened. Jim Ski, a professor at Imperial College London and co-chair of the working group behind the report, said, "It's now or never. If we want to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius without immediate and deep emissions reductions across all sectors, it will be impossible. The report on Monday, April 4th, was the third and final section of the IPCC's latest comprehensive review of climate science, drawing on the work of thousands of scientists. IPCC reports take about 7 years to compile, making this potentially the last warning before the world is set irrevocably on a path to climate breakdown. Though the report found it was now almost inevitable that temperatures would rise above 1.5 degrees Celsius, the level above which many of the effects of climate breakdown will become irreversible, the IPCC said it could be possible to bring them back down below the critical level by the end of this century. But doing so could require technologies to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which campaigners warned were unproven and could not be a substitute of deep emissions cuts now. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said some governments and businesses were lying in claiming to be on track for 1.5 degrees Celsius. In a strongly worded rebuke, he warned some government and business leaders are saying one thing but doing another. Simply put, they are lying, and the results will be catastrophic. Soaring energy prices and the war in Ukraine have prompted governments to rethink their energy policies. Many countries, including the US, the UK, and EU, are considering ramping up fossil fuels as part of their response, but the IPCC report made clear that increasing fossil fuels would put the 1.5 degrees Celsius target beyond reach. Guterres said inflation is rising and the war in Ukraine is causing food and energy prices to skyrocket, but increasing fossil fuel production will only make matters worse. John Kerry, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, called the report a defining moment for the planet and warned governments must move faster. He said, "The report tells us that we are currently falling short in our battle to avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis and mobilize the urgent global action needed. But importantly, the report also tells us we have the tools we need to reach our goals, cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030, reach net zero by 2050, and secure a healthier, cleaner planet." The IPCC Working Group 3 report found coal must be effectively phased out if the world is to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius, and currently planned new fossil fuel infrastructure would cause the world to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius. Methane emissions must be reduced by a third. Growing forests and preserving soils will be necessary, but three, planting cannot for fossil fuels do enough to compensate for continued emissions. Investment in the shift to a low-carbon world is about six times lower than it needs to be. And all sectors of the global economy, from energy and transport to buildings and food, must change dramatically and rapidly. And new technologies, including hydrogen fuel and carbon capture and storage, will be needed. Peter Smith, a professor of soils and global change at Aberdeen University, said, "The time of reckoning is now. We have one decade to get on track. We use fossil fuels in all the things that we need to change." Poor countries warned they were ill-equipped to make the changes needed and required financial assistance from richer nations to cut emissions and help them adapt to the impacts of the climate crisis. Madeleine Diouf-Sarr, the chair of the Least Developed Countries Group at the UN Climate Talk, said, "There can be no new fossil fuel infrastructure. The emissions from existing and planned infrastructure alone are higher than scenarios consistent with limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius with no or limited overshoot. We cannot afford to lock in the use of fossil fuels." Catherine Mitchell, a professor emerita of energy policy at Exeter University, said the needs of the poorest countries must be prioritized. Unless we have social justice, there are not going to be more accelerated greenhouse gas reductions. These issues are tied together. Publication of the report was delayed by a few hours as governments wrangled with scientists in marathon sessions, culminating late on Sunday night, April 3rd, over the final messages in the 63-page summary for policymakers. While IPCC reports are led by scientists, governments have input on the final messages in the summary for policymakers. The Guardian understands that governments, including India, Saudi Arabia, and China, questioned messages, including on financing emissions reductions in the developing world and phasing out fossil fuels. However, scientists stress that the final summary was agreed by all 195 governments. This was the third installment of IPCC's sixth assessment report, covering ways of reducing emissions. It follows the first section published last August that warned human changes to the climate were becoming irreversible, and a second section published at the end of February warning of catastrophic impacts.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the remnant of God on earth. Greetings to the great Iranian nation who has created an epic in the literal sense of the word today. Greetings be upon our late magnanimous Imam who was the architect of this auspicious foundation for eternity. As far as I know, and according to what I have witnessed today, the presence of the people throughout the country has been an epic turnout in the pure sense of the word. It was magnificent. The people entered the arena with complete motivation. This great movement of the people is something big and is a blessing. Your presence in the political and public areas of defending Quds is a true defense of Quds. This is a true defense. Those who are defending Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the first Qibla, direction for prayer of the Muslims, with their bodies and souls, will be encouraged with your movement. They will gain energy and become more resistant, and with God's grace, the Palestinian cause and the great Palestinian fight is closed to its final conclusion, which will be a blessed conclusion, God willing.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, I will speak about certain points about Quds and Palestine with our dear Palestinian brothers, and I will say this part in Arabic. I have spoken at length about this matter with our own people many times. Today, I wish to address the Palestinian brothers and the entire world of Islam, in particular our Arab brothers. In the name of God, the Beneficent and the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon the Master of all humanity and the most honorable human being, our Master Muhammad al-Mustafa, the last messenger, upon his immaculate progeny, upon his chosen companions, and upon those who follow them until the Day of Judgment. Greetings to all Muslim brothers and sisters throughout the world. Greetings to the youth of the world of Islam. Greetings to the courageous, zealous youth of Palestine and upon all the people of Palestine. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The truth is that as long as the surprising criminal Zionist regime is dominating over Quds, all days of the year should be considered to be Quds Day.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist establishment as well as Washington is cold and full of excuses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Miko Pled, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Will Shirin Abu Aqila's Murder Mark a Turning Point in Liberation of Palestine? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The world is trying to make sense of the brutal assassination of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aqila, who was targeted by the Zionist regime forces while covering yet another Israeli assault on Jenin. Furthermore, the Zionist regime forces have now attacked the funeral procession leading Shirin to her final resting place. One wonders, why is anyone surprised? How often have we seen innocent lives taken? How often have we seen the Zionist regime's military attack funeral processions? And yet, for reasons that perhaps cannot be explained, awe, sadness, and despair have descended upon the world with this particular killing. This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist regime and Washington is cold and full of excuses. On the same day, the funeral procession of Shirin was taking place in Al-Quds. A memorial procession was taking place in the ancient city of Lid. This procession was to commemorate the murder of Musa Hassouna. It was a year ago in Lid, as settler gangs were assaulting Palestinians in Lid, that Musa Hassouna was murdered. This procession, besides being a memorial to the killing, was also a reminder that the Zionist regime's authorities decided to close the case against the only suspects who were on the scene and who fired their weapons at the same place and the same time as Musa was killed. Sources in Lid say that the Zionist regime's Minister of Interior called the local DA to demand that they close the case on grounds of self-defense. Of course, we are all well aware that Musa and Shirin, who were murdered 1 year apart, were not the only victims of the Zionist regime's violence. They were joined by countless others who, without cause or trial, were taken from their loved ones, from their people, and turned into martyrs for the cause. Sure enough, once again, we are forced to look at reality in the face and accept that no one will save Palestine, but all people around the world united. No one else can free Palestine. No one can save Palestinians from the long, violent, heartless arm of the Zionist apartheid regime. Only a unity of purpose and an uncompromising pro-Palestinian, pro-justice, pro-liberation agenda can save Palestine and its people from bloodshed and destruction. Contrary to the common misconception regarding the pro-Palestinian camp, a clear and uncompromising message regarding Palestine does have the capacity to unite people of different backgrounds, faiths, and even political affiliations. One is hard-pressed to think of any other issue on which all of these groups could find common ground. Yet, Al Alda New York, with its message of a free, decolonized Palestine, managed to do just that. The misconception is that in order to present the Palestine case, in order to achieve the goals of those of seek to free Palestine, we must go slow. We must first crawl before we walk and run. We are told. In other words, in order to achieve the liberation of Palestine, we must tread lightly so as not to upset anyone. This was never true, and it is not true today. The opposition to the cause of justice has always been fierce, and in the case of Palestine, the Zionists have learned from other oppressors and refined their methods. This means that the struggle for justice and liberation in Palestine is challenging and demanding. And we who stand on the side of justice and liberation have to work harder and smarter than those who had to fight in the other arenas. We need to reclaim Palestine by teaching the world that what they wrongly refer to as Israel is actually occupied Palestine, and that a glorious history was cut out from the curriculum, and therefore they don't know about the long impressive history of this land, Palestine, which sits at a crucial crossroads uniting Asia, Africa, and Europe. We need to teach the world that whatever the Zionists had told them was a lie. And then we must be there and, in no uncertain terms, provide the truth.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even saving, now you got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up, petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit to until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing one in two people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic, and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Said Pureza, London.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible